Thank you, Martine. It's getting very intense, talk after talk. How many people have listening fatigue? That doesn't mean it isn't great. It means it's too great. We're stirred up with so many ideas. So thank you, Martine, for organizing this, and thank you, Musang, for always being the host of these wonderful occasions. So unfortunately, I made a decision to write a paper and read it, which, in retrospect, not the best idea, but that's the way it's going to go. It's quite, so I'm going to talk about Vedana from the standpoint of a practitioner in the Goenka tradition, and I'm going to also talk about Vedana from the standpoint of a biological scientist giving a biological, chemical, physical explanation for body sensations. So it's going to be a little technical. The title is Vedana and the Wisdom of Impermanence. And it says, we are precipitants within the experiments of the universe. I would like to tell you about the advantages that accrue to a particular interpretation of Vedana. I'm going to talk with you as a person who meditates both for my personal benefit and also as my social contribution to the world around me. I'm not a Buddhist. I do not know Pali, and I cannot claim any authority regarding the interpretation of Vedana that I will be using in this talk. Instead, I will be describing Vedana as it was defined by my meditation teacher, Mr. S.N. Goenka, who taught Vipassana meditation based upon the definition of Vedana as body sensations. The word Vedana, as I'm using it, is an English language word in the community of Vipassana meditators who have borrowed it from the Pali. Vedana is understood as a term that occurs in the 12-fold chain of conditioned causality as taught by the Buddha, and it lies between contact and craving. In the Vipassana community, in which meditators follow the teaching of Mr. Goenka, Vedana means body sensations that we contact through mindful awareness of them. These sensations can trigger either the next causal step in the 12-fold chain, craving, which leads to more ignorance and attachment, or Vedana can be the nexus at which craving ceases to arise and therefore leads to the path of cessation from craving, cessation from craving's attendant attachment with its subsequent suffering. When a meditator is aware of Vedana, body sensations, without generating craving and attachment, he or she enters the chain of causality that leads to freedom from ignorance about oneself. Awareness of Vedana in a neutral, non-commentarial manner is the key step to reducing suffering and to generating wisdom. I've defined my talk today as an explanation of the benefits that this interpretation of Vedana brings to the secular meditator like myself. Interpreting Vedana to mean body sensations has two advantages. First, it provides a meditation focus upon the direct experience of impermanence and change within one's own mind and body. This focus is a clear directive that most people can follow into sustained meditation practice. Second, this interpretation of Vedana leads to a meditation experience that is fully integrated with the scientific worldview. Interpreting Vedana as sensations and making them and their changes the focus of meditative mindfulness leads to an experience of reality in which all compounded things are aggregates of smaller things. All are subject to constant change, and all are impermanent. This is both the realization of Buddhist meditation and the data-rich, multidisciplinary conclusion of the modern scientific worldview. To begin, let's start with a brief overview of how Vipassana is actually practiced. When I practice Vipassana meditation as taught by Mr. Goenka, I try to focus my attention on all the sensations of my body, either observing specific parts of my body, such as my breath going in and out while passing and touching my nostrils, or observing multiple parts of my body, such as simultaneously observing my two hands and two feet, or scanning my body up and down, or simply observing the whole body all at once. And under all of these circumstances, I'm trying to directly experience the sensations of my body. At one level, the sensations of my body are a product of my environment, such as the temperature of my location, or the sensations could be the product of my diet, such as whether a cheese pizza I ate 2 hours ago has triggered my lactose intolerance. The sensations of my body may also derive from physiological processes, such as the beating of my heart or the heaving of my chest caused by respiration. The sensations produced by these examples of physiological motility are certainly foci for my meditative mindful awareness of sensations throughout my body. But at a deeper level, which is simultaneous to and physically embedded within the physiological level, the sensations of my body are numerous, dynamic, infinitesimal cascades of much smaller changes that are occurring in the physical substrate of my being. Over a lifetime of meditating upon sensations, it is these sub-physiologic zones of Vedana that become increasingly contactable, and through contact with which arise the more transformative realizations that Vipassana awakens. I would like to guide you on a mental journey into the experience and realization of meditation on Vedana when it's interpreted as body sensations. This journey will lead us from the vibrations of our bodies that we make contact as we meditate into emotionally and scientifically important realms of reality. Let's go back to those deeper sub-physiologic zones of sensations. The subtle sensations of our body have many causes, more than can be scientifically named or understood. For our journey today, I will simplify certain collections of causes of subtle sensations and describe these causal constellations as if they're entities. I will assume the mind and body are so closely interconnected that thoughts cause body sensations because thoughts require neurotransmitter flows that have a biophysical basis. And I will assume that body sensations can also trigger thoughts, such as when we feel hunger and then we think, I'm hungry. Our sensations and transformations occur at the bidirectional intersection of mind and body, where thoughts move molecules and where body sensations trigger thoughts. The subtle sensations that we can learn to contact in our bodies through long-term sustained meditation are caused by the numerous molecular transformations of which biology consists. All the sensuousness or pain of our bodies, all the delight or turmoil of our minds, are transformations within the atomic molecular substrate of the body. This is the ultimate truth about ourselves that we can become attuned to through our awareness of the ceaseless changes in the sensations that are the analogs of the fluid, chemical, and physical underpinnings of our minds and bodies. The dynamism of our changing subtle sensations reflects the movements of the world. Our bodies are collections of atoms that are organized into molecules that function in the activities of cells that cohere to form tissues which interrelate to create an organism. Our bodies are not solid, but are molecules suspended in realms of other molecules, all of which are undergoing continuous biotransformation. We are molecules aggregated and in constant flux. Trying to give scientific language to this molecular flux, we need to describe three pathways. The first is the material of which we consist, like atoms. The second pathway is the energy that maintains and transforms the molecular aggregates. The third pathway is the information that organizes matter and energy. Meditation on sensations provides us with a direct experience of ourselves as temporarily cohering nodes of matter, energy, and information. We can be said to consist of materials that are very large collections of atoms. Of course, atoms are also collections of smaller particles, such as electrons or protons, but for the moment, let's first focus upon our bodies at the descriptive level as atomic aggregates. Depending upon our particular body size and also depending to some degree on the way we make our estimates, our body consists of approximately 8 octillion atoms. This was an estimate that was used by Carl Sagan, but there are some scientists here, so you can deduce it from Avogadro's number and the probability of hydrogen, nitrogen, etc. in our bodies. But Carl Sagan came up with 8 octillion. Octillion is a number that is too big for us to comprehend. Even trillions are beyond our comprehension since we live only for billions of seconds. We live for about 5 billion seconds, which is way below a trillion. We can't count to 1 trillion, even if we did nothing else for every waking and sleeping second of our lives. But these unimaginably gigantic trillions are only 1,000th of quadrillions, which are only 1/1,000th of quintillions, and so on. We consist of atomic aggregates too numerous for us to comprehend. We can tabulate these gigantic numbers, but we can't really assign meaning to them or relate to them emotionally. This non-comprehensible, transcognitive nature of our own being is one of the reasons why we experience a sense of wonder about our life, which is wonder is a way of encountering wholes that exceed our cognitive capacity. I've emphasized this point in my study of wonder, and this talk today is based upon ideas that I've described in more detail in my book about wonder. You could say, to write this paper, I hacked my book on wonder. These very large number of atoms of which we consist and which we cannot comprehend are an underestimation of the aggregates of our material nature. Even if we ignore subatomic units like protons and electrons, we all know that our atomic materials are constantly dying off, sloughing, disaggregating, and being resupplied by the atoms in our food. We have to keep editing, rebuilding, and remodeling our continuously decaying physical bodies. The atoms that compose us at any one point in time are only a fraction of the atoms of which we consist throughout our lifetime. The number of atoms that we employ to build our dynamic but temporary physical selves is not really something we can understand. The numbers get very big. Almost all the atoms that we consist of at any one point in time are organized into the larger units called molecules. Molecules vary in size from a single atomic ion to gigantic molecules that consist of billions of atoms. The large collagen molecules in our fibrous tissue that give resilience and strength to our muscles and tendons may contain millions of atoms. We contain more sizes and kinds of molecules that can yet be enumerated through science. Our master molecules are the information containing DNA. DNA is a molecule that contains billions of atoms. Since we have trillions of cells, and every cell has DNA, we have trillions of DNA molecules that contain billions of atoms. So you can see immediately that just our DNA alone produces transcalculable amounts of material made out of atoms. We're pretty good. All of our octillions of atoms are put into place. We permit as few of them as possible from becoming dislocated free-floating radicals. Putting atoms into place in a DNA molecule, for example, means that two more pathways of existence beyond materials have to be activated. Remember that we're discussing the science of our bodies in order to understand body sensations, Vedana, and then to understand the value of meditating on Vedana. It's a funny thing, if you use spell check, which civilized people shouldn't do, spell check will change words. So here it says, to understand the value of meditating on Vedanta. I've been hijacked and moved to the wrong conference. Let's go back to our atoms. Moving atoms requires energy. Atoms are put into place in our bodies through energetic biotransformation. The energy that rearranges atoms and that makes molecules, enzymes, proteins, carbohydrates, cells, etc., this energy comes from the food which had also supplied our material. So food provides matter and energy. The energy in our food is located in between the atoms of the food we have eaten. Okay, brief course on biochemistry, very familiar to some of you, maybe new to others. The energy in our food is located in between the atoms of the food we have just eaten. In between the atoms of our food are electromagnetic connections between the atoms, which we call chemical bonds. Atoms hold each other in place electromagnetically due to laws in the domains of physics and chemistry. Atoms cooperate and cohere in consequence of the electromagnetic charges they embody. The electromagnetism in atoms, in turn, derives from the balances among electrons and protons in the subatomic realm of matter. But for the purposes of our understanding today, as we focus on the atomic nature of our being, we find atoms cleaving to each other electromagnetically in food molecules. And we find atoms breaking apart and releasing electromagnetic energy that then can be used to build new bonds to form new molecules. So the use of energy to create new bonds and new molecules is called biotransformation. Biotransformation is the basis of Vedana, body sensations. Molecules can break apart to form matter and energy for new molecules, or can break apart simply as decay. As the atomic material of our bodies electromagnetically clings to each other within molecules, or reaggregates into new organizations of atoms in new molecules, these bioenergetic processes are guided by information. Our bodies are atomic aggregates in transformations that require energy and that are guided by the information systems that lead to the organizations that we call us. Most people, most of the time, tend to imagine themselves as constant and permanent. Human beings have a tendency to identify with the organized collections of atoms that actually is only passing through our informatically arranged biotransformations at any one moment. The information in our DNA has been compiled over approximately 4 billion years of biological evolution. Each DNA molecule was printed out from a previous DNA molecule. They change gradually over adaptive selection, natural selection. And the DNA in me is a direct linear printout with errors and selections from cells that lived billions of years ago. Our DNA tells atoms, molecules, and other parts of us how to be living things that we are. DNA organizes the atoms, molecules, and cells into complex adaptive systems that we call humans, or wolves, or oak trees. We are formed in utero mostly by the sequential information coded in a combination of our parents' DNA. But actually, deep inside the atoms that form the molecules of our bodies, inside the atoms is information from the realm we call physics, which contains information that's approximately 14 billion years old. DNA is not the only source of information within us. It's the source of bioinformation. But every atom in the universe has information in it from the domain we call the laws of nature. Through the intraatomic, within the atom information, the subatomic particles, which we've been ignoring up till now, like electrons and protons, become lawful enough for atoms to get built up. How do electrons and protons cohere into an atom? They have to have information that tells them how to be an atom. So atoms get built up out of smaller grains, like electrons and protons, of the universe's matter. And atoms, in turn, allow for the bigger domains of biology, baseball, and babies. We are partly products of our food, our thoughts, and feelings, and also of the universe. The subtlest guidance of the universe is within us. We exist temporarily because there is some deep reliability within things. The aggregates in our bodies that biotransform and generate Vedana are built up from matter, energy, and the laws of the universe. In recent years, as I have entered, or I could say hit, my eighth decade, I often find some delay in my cognitive information retrieval systems. And when I was writing this article, I found myself trying to think of the name of the folk singer who wrote the song Poncho and Lefty, which Willie Nelson and Merle Haggard sing. And I was going, what is the name of that guy? And my wife had to tell me, it's Towns Van Zandt. Anybody know that name? No. So you all have retrieval problems, so you do. But younger people, like me. It sometimes takes my brain an extra moment or five for me to access some well-known cognitive information. So many of you will hit the stage where you meet your friend who you've known for 50 years and you go, hi, Fred. But it's interesting to contemplate the fact that I have no trouble automatically and unconsciously retrieving information from the universe that's 14 billion years old. And I can use that information to organize the physical chemistry comprising trillions of molecules, octillions of atoms that cohere in place to form my physical being. What a memory I have. Most of the information that guides our dynamic being is entirely unconscious. Beyond retrieval by our minds access only a thin skim of our information. We are much more complicated and well-informed than we usually credit ourselves for being. Not only my information, but ignorance is also a powerful force. Ignorance may well be the root of suffering, and it is often one of the roots of particular forms of maladaptation in human societies. But information, not ignorance, is the source of life. And the organization of atoms and energy into human beings requires information. We cohere for a while because the universe is informatic, combinatorial, proliferative, and creative. The particles of matter combine according to laws and have expanded to cover our entire planet in endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful. That's a quote from Charles Darwin. Endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful. That's the conclusion of The Origin of Species. Darwin's extraordinary and frequently quoted phrase. Information has enabled the stars, galaxies, solar system, and evolution of life. we can aspire to wisdom because there is some analog for it within the workings of the world. The universe may well be partly chaotic, but it certainly contains some predictability, order, and lawfulness. The wisdom we contact pre-exists. We are products of the lawful, combinatorial, creative universe. We are discussing all this because we are discussing body sensations, vedana, which attest to the many changes that occur in our atomic, molecular, energetic, information-guided aggregate substrate that we label us. It is now obvious that we have no essence or enduring self. We are precipitants within the experiments of the universe. We are localized nodes of cosmic processes that sift, collate, and combine matter, energy, and information across light years and eons. Our bodies and the earth on which we stand are formed and dissolve according to universal law. Let's look more specifically at how our matter, energy, and information function to create body sensations, or vedana. So far, we've derived our material and energy from our food, but let's take a look at how our food got matter and energy in the first place. To understand vedana as a manifestation of the scientific universe, we have to expand our inquiry to the cosmos, to the ways in which matter and energy become available to our bodies and our minds. What we call food means organic molecules derived from plant or animal matter. But all organic molecules have their start when plants capture sunlight through photosynthesis. Photosynthesis is the sacred golden ring through which solar energy becomes utilizable by living systems like our biosphere on Earth. In this remarkable cosmic invention, photosynthesis, the energy of sunlight, photons, kick up electrons to a higher energetic level. The solar photons, which can be thought of as packets of energy, can be described as colliding with and accelerating the motion of specially adapted electrons within the chemicals of the photosynthetic green plant. So the photon adds energy to the special electrons in chlorophyll in green plants, which have now absorbed the energy of the sun. This absorbed energy of the sun is the start of everything in our biosphere, including every one of us. The newly absorbed solar energy can be used to create electromagnetic chemical bonds between atoms in order to make molecules. This is the origin of the energy that I was discussing earlier. The green plant can now form our mother molecule, sugar. From sugar molecules, plants build the rest of their organic molecules, which in turn are the origin of the biosphere. Everything that is green, furry, feathered, waves in the wind, flies, or runs, does so with the energy of the sun, captured by electrons during photosynthesis and passed through sugar. The energy that moves molecules in our body and creates our vedana is solar energy that was captured and transmit it to life via photosynthesis. So if I raise my arm like this, the energy to raise my arm came from the sun. Let's notice that photosynthesis depends upon a virtuous cycle. In order for the electrons in plants to capture solar photons, those electrons have to already be in organic molecules in plants, like chlorophyll. Only very specific organizations of atoms and molecules can capture solar energy. So you see the positive cycle. Plants capture solar photons by using complex organic molecules like chlorophyll, but plants and their chlorophyll need to be built by using solar energy in the first place. It's because of this need for life to be in place in order for life to make itself that it took our planet billions of years to generate complex photosynthetic organisms. Billions of years means lots of experiments. Early primitive cells had to stumble upon photosynthesis. Pre-existing, early, less complex life forms had to be present and mutate through unintentional adaptation into the capacity to receive energy directly from the sun before our current biosphere could effloresce. Our lives are threaded needles. We have derived from a long cosmic dream. It's not obvious that life must come into being. Does the universe intend us? Or are we the accidental outcome of a lot of stirring and mixing of a lot of matter, energy, and information over trillions of miles and billions of years of accidental experiments? It's not clear whether biology is a necessary subsequent step to the realm of physics. We don't know whether the complex combinatorial universe of organic molecules that we call life was a mere quirk, a mere happenstance, a one-off event on one planet, or whether, on the contrary, life is driven into being by strong determining forces that spring into being repeatedly across many solar systems and many galaxies many times. As we consider these unanswerable questions from our own perspective, life is both too complicated to have ever happened, and yet it is our old familiar tune. We tend to feel a contradiction. Life sounds improbable and feels inevitable. Human life is a recent addendum to 4 billion years of organic evolution on Earth and to 14 billion years of cosmic evolution. Only 70 million years ago, not that long, life was dinosaurs, not people. This very long, very slow creation of us seems to have a lot of weird diversions and useless blind alleys. Was Triceratops really a necessary way station on the road to humans, Bob Dylan, and the Nobel Prizes? But you and I, we have life, and we move, speak, and think with the energy of our great golden sun. The energy which the sun exudes actually derives from the fusion of hydrogen atoms in the dense hot center of the sun. The hydrogen fusion that leads to helium and other new elements inside the sun also creates the excess energy that we call sunlight or solar photons. Therefore, all the energy that plants bring in to our biosphere from sunlight that becomes our food and powers our thought and emotions. All that energy comes from inside hydrogen atoms. We are hydrogen-fueled vehicles. Hydrogen fuels the Vedana in our skin or guts. We owe it to the prophet of science, Einstein, that we know matter and energy are actually different forms of each other. Matter can be converted into the wild energy of atomic bombs. The first energy of the first moments of the universe became matter, predominantly subatomic particles like electrons. It took hundreds of thousands of years before the earliest small subatomic forms of matter coalesced into atoms. Atoms are not units, but collections of even smaller things. It was a long wait until subatomic plasma that populated the expanding space of the universe became atoms. Most of the visible matter of the universe is still the simplest atom, hydrogen. These hydrogen atoms clump into stars, which are the furnaces that make other bigger atomic nuclei, like all the stuff in our bodies, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, etc. Because matter is actually a form of energy, and because matter consists of subatomic particles, which share properties of both matter and energy, we can consider that at the deepest level, the universe is oscillating matter-energy. The vibration of an infinitely regressing substrate, whose nature remains unknown to us today, hidden inside the mysteries of physics, contained by quarks, strings, Higgs bosons, or other potentially ultimate realities. Scientific experts are probing realities too arcane for language and understandable only through particle physics and mathematics. The deepest interpretation of Vedana, the sensations of our bodies that we become aware of as we meditate mindfully upon them, is that Vedana derived from the wavelets or vibrations of the ultimate matter-energy matrix of the universe. Vedana, or body sensations, may be not only biological, about the movement of atoms and molecules, but also physical, about quantum flux in the depth of things. A friend of mine who's a very advanced Vipassana meditator read my book about wonder, which focuses predominantly upon the transformations of atoms and molecules, the biological level, not the physical level, in the human body. She asked me why I had not referred more to the oscillations of ultimate matter. The vibrations where quantum possibilities allow the finest subatomic particles to emerge from undefinable pre-existence. That's what the Buddha was feeling when he practiced Vipassana to discern the 12-fold chain of causality and to coin the term Vedana. Those of you who feel the ultimate oscillations of the universe in your bodies as you meditate can now arise and take your seat under the Bodhi tree. For the rest of us, for me, it's more probable that our meditation at best carries us into direct meditative mindful experience of the arising and passing of our octillion-fold biological, atomic, molecular matter and energy. The sensations that most of us can feel changing in our bodies as we meditate are caused by the atoms and molecules in our cells. Quite probably for most Vipassana meditators, most of the time, the body sensations that we feel arising and passing in almost instantaneous sequence, those vibrating, tingling, unlabelable sensations, are linked to the biological creation and destruction that we embody. we are probably experiencing our sensory nerve endings contacting our skin and generating chemical messengers that bring environmental information back to our brains. We are probably experiencing nociceptors generating chemical messengers to relay information to our brains about the status of our musculature. We are probably experiencing the flow of red cells and plasma through our arteries, arterioles, and capillaries. We are probably experiencing thermoregulators located inside the hypothalamus of our brainstem, changing our temperature up or down by regulating the rate at which we metabolize fats and sugars from our bloodstream and our fat cells. There are so many levels, so many transformations that are simultaneously and instantaneously creating and maintaining our temporary aggregates of organic molecules. And it is these that we come into contact with when we meditate upon body sensations, Vedana. Not only our bodies, but our thoughts and feelings all stir Vedana. And therefore, as we meditate on Vedana, body sensations, we encounter many swirls of emotional storms. Vipassana is not some cool, distanced peering into the universe. Meditation is a dip into the geysers of our being. Every grief or ecstasy we have ever felt is an analog of roiling aggregates of Vedana. Our emotions are embodied in biotransformation throughout our being. We feel our emotions secondary to many molecular changes in our brain, endocrine organs, hearts, guts, even skin. Meditation includes many states of mind, such as distraction, daydream, reverie, memory, and reflections. But the goal of meditation is to return to a penetrating realization. If Vedana is understood as body sensations, and if Vedana is understood as the nexus where craving does or does not occur, then body sensations become the pathway to craving free or at least craving diminished equanimity. Simultaneously, Vedana, or body sensations, become the nexus of the realization of the impermanence of our atomic, molecular, compounded, so-called self. This puts our meditation in line with the Buddha's final summary. All compounded things are impermanent. Therefore, Vedana, understood as body sensations, helps the meditator reduce or cease craving and attain an equanimity that is coterminous with the realization of anicca, the insubstantiality of every formed thing in the universe. Finally, I would like to affirm the implication that the universe is not all matter and energy. Non-compounded things like information may pre-exist the universe or may be intrinsically built into the universe in a non-reducible, non-compounded, non-entropic way. One thought process by which the modern scientific meditator like myself can consider the term Dhamma is to relate it to the scientific laws, the cosmic constraints that create the channels that impersonally guide the universal processes that form galaxies and my body. Understanding ourselves and everything around us as selflessly insubstantial, while simultaneously being vessels of Dhamma, universal law, the information that guides the universe. Understanding those two simultaneously, everything is insubstantial, everything contains Dhamma, may be a hopeful meditation-derived realization that might reduce suffering in us and in our human world. We are impermanent, but we aren't meaningless. We carry the laws of life and realization within us. Now at last we can look with wonder upon this whole process of observing Vedana without reacting. It should be clear that in order for me or anyone to feel Vedana and to understand its impermanence, this requires the 14 billion year long history of the universe, the 4 billion year long evolution of life on Earth, by which matter, energy, and information cohere temporarily into the process of me, by which life, meaning all of us, could become aware, observational, equanimous, and insightful about the fundamental truths of impermanence and lawfulness. At the juncture of Vedana, awareness can become liberating wisdom. At the juncture of Vedana, an animal on earth can understand key features of the universe from which we emerged. At the junction of Vedana, the universe can become self-realizing. That's us. Speaking personally, the interpretation of Vedana as body sensations has given me a focus for meditation that allows me to feel I'm a student of the Buddha without my having to embrace every detail of an organized religion like the various historical Buddhisms. It has allowed me to remain embedded in the biomedical world I studied in my youth, of the electron microscope, the double helix, the Hubble Space Telescope, while I walk the path of meditation. Realization of impermanence and the absence of an enduring self has given me a modicum of comfort and guidance. My judgments tend to be based upon a bigger perspective. I can balance myself better by seeing my perceived problems in a larger context and in a more radiant light. I can seek out friends among the good and the wise who, according to the Buddha, are the path itself.